Eye campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May.
The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power, and speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's Ebihan and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
one loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The debate.
Russia accuses Britain and the United States of trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea by refusing to accept that Crimea is part of Russia. Tensions run high following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula On Wednesday, the UK said their ship was conducting innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters. Russia says its forces fired warning shots and dropped bombs to deter the British ship, accusing it of entering Russia's territorial waters. Both sides accuse each other of producing inaccurate accounts of the standoff. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that Moscow will defend its borders by all means, warning Britain that in the future bombs would be sent not only in its path but also on target if there were any further provocative actions. Joining us on today, we have our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Amina, please bring us up to speed where these tensions could be heading.
Well, unfortunately, Bardia, it's never a good sign when an escalation of this magnitude concerns as many countries as it does, because we're not just talking about whatever a country's particular position is on the 2014 standoff between the Ukraine and, of course, the Russian Federation here. Britain conducted what they're saying was an innocent naval exercise in disputed waters. So it didn't even really matter, actually, if they believed that those waters were the territorial property of the Russian Federation or not. The fact that you would stir the pot, as it will, by having HMS Defender come through that territory at such diplomatically sensitive times. There are, of course, naval exercises, Operation Sea Breeze, taking place in the Black Sea nearby, which Russia has called on the United States and its allies to cancel. And for Britain to do this act at this time is sending one very clear message. It is an escalation in events, and it doesn't matter what the Prime Minister and the Ministry of Defense say about disputing the sequence of events or disputing whether or not bombs were dropped and shots were fired. The fact is, in such sensitive areas, in such a sensitive situation, to have your naval vessel, your armed naval vessel, go all that way from British waters to essentially stir up a hornet's nest is not really sending a message of diplomacy and a message of wanting to take this as a matter between the Russians and the Ukrainians. The United Kingdom and the United States have clearly chosen sides here, and depending on who blinks next, this could be a serious, very serious issue. Let's not be candid about it, Bardia. Let's not mince our words here. International global conflicts have started for less.
All right, thanks a lot. Amina Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're bringing in now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos, who's with us also from the British capital. Mr. Papadopoulos, welcome to the program. Talk to us about where this incident happened and whether Russia's response was justified, in your opinion.
Well, the staged provocation orchestrated by Britain and America, in which a Royal Navy vessel, specifically HMS Defender, illegally entered Russian maritime waters adjacent to the Crimea, was a foolhardy and, worse still, an exceedingly dangerous act which could have provoked a military conflict between the West and Russia. And I say that America was also involved in this staged provocation because London and Washington work in unison on the international stage, especially when it comes to Russia. So the question we have to address is this: why did London and Washington stage a provocation in Russian maritime waters? I do not believe that the West seriously intends to provoke a conflict with the Russian Federation, because a conflict with the Russian Federation would start with a military conflict and would rapidly escalate into a nuclear conflict in which mankind would, simply put, be wiped out. So I believe that the intended objective of the British-American staged provocation was to add momentum to building up the case for, firstly, NATO's increasing presence on the western border of the Russian Federation, and secondly, for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO. The official argument of the British government that British naval vessels are perfectly entitled to enter the waters around the Crimea because London does not recognize the Crimea as part of Russia, instead it recognizes the Crimea as part of Ukraine, is untenable. Why? Firstly, even though London never recognized the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania as part of the Soviet Union, nonetheless, the British government never deployed Royal Naval vessels to Soviet maritime waters off the coast of the Baltic states. And secondly, if the logic of the British government is to be extended across the world, then other nations in the world should not accept or respect British jurisdiction over the north of Ireland or Northern Ireland, or British jurisdiction over the Falkland Islands or the Malvinas, or indeed British jurisdiction over the Chagos Islands. So quite frankly, the British-American staged provocation was part and parcel of a campaign to build up the case for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO, to portray Russia in an exceedingly negative way in which the Russians are projected as aggressive and dangerous, and thirdly, to justify the increase in NATO's budget and thereby defend the ongoing increases in NATO soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea.
Okay, Mr. Papadopoulos, you pretty much said it all. That almost wraps up the debate for us. Let's cross over now to editor of Veterans Today, Mr. Mike Harris, who's joining us from Phoenix. Mr. Harris, welcome to the program. I'm sure you were listening to what Mr. Papadopoulos was saying in London. Give us your viewpoint on this. Was this a provocation by the British Royal Navy, or was it what they are saying themselves, a legitimate exercising of the right of passage at sea?
So it absolutely was a provocation by the British Navy. And in fact, on Veterans Today, we published today the tape that the FSB released from the bridge of the Russian warship that fired the three rounds across the bow of the British destroyer. So that is up, it's there. The British destroyer was warned both in English and in Russian multiple times, and they ignored their warnings and proceeded ahead. And after multiple warnings, then the Russian ship did fire warning shots across the bow to back the British off. So they were duly warned verbally multiple times, and they proceeded anyway. So this was a British provocation. Now you have to remember that the U.S. has been meddling in Ukrainian affairs since 2004. I was there in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, and I have been to Crimea, I've been to the Russian naval base in Sevastopol, and Russia is not going to give that asset up. They have an agreement with the Ukrainian government to keep functioning. And if you remember correctly, after Victoria Nuland and the U.S. CIA and other intelligence agencies toppled the Yanukovych government, the Crimean people voted overwhelmingly via referendum to join the Russian Federation. And so they seceded from Russia, and they went back to being, seceded from Ukraine, and went back to being a Russian state. That which is where they were before Nikita Khrushchev ceded Crimea to Ukraine back in 1959, 1960, I forget the exact date. But historically, Crimea has been a Russian asset. And historically, most of Ukraine has been a Russian asset. If you go back historically, the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, used to be the capital of the Russian Empire. So people need to keep this in mind, that these are primarily Russian people, Slavic people from Russia, Russian speaking, and the U.S. is over there meddling and interfering, and the British are helping them.
Right. Mr. Papadopoulos, let's go over some of the details of the timeline. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson On Thursday, he said that it was entirely right for their warship to travel through the waters off Crimea, and it was acting in accordance with international law. Now, this is all going on as there's amid a diplomatic spat between Russia and London. When tensions were high between Kiev and Moscow back in 2018, the UK also sent a Royal Navy ship to the Black Sea port of Odessa in a show of support for Ukraine. This, of course, happened in 2018, so this is not without precedent, is it?
The root cause of tension between the West and Russia revolves around NATO expansion into Eastern Europe and also into the Baltic states, which formerly were a part of the USSR. Now, the Americans have been coveting Ukraine ever since Ukraine became an independent state in December of 1991. Why is Ukraine so important to Washington? Namely, if America is successful in its ambition to admit Ukraine into the ranks of NATO, then America will be the dominant naval power in the Black Sea. Russian influence and power in Europe would be severely curtailed, and thereby Russian influence and power in the world in general would be severely curtailed. The British government cites international law as the basis for why HMS Defender entered the waters around the Crimea. But quite frankly speaking, the British government doesn't have a leg to stand on, so to speak, because the Ukrainian constitution was severely violated in February of 2014 when a democratically elected president who was recognized by both America and the European Union and also Britain was overthrown in a Western orchestrated coup. Therefore, the Ukrainian constitution was in February 2014 dead, so to speak. And as a result of the coup, which brought to power authorities which had no legitimacy whatsoever, the people of the Crimea, who are overwhelmingly Russian, and those people who identify as Ukrainian but nonetheless regard Russia as their mother country, came together to resist what had happened in Kiev and to seize the opportunity to break away from Kiev and to reunite with Russia. And that was the will of the people of the Crimea. As I said moments ago, if the British are going to apply the argument that their Royal Navy vessels can enter the waters of the Crimea because they do not recognize the Crimea as part of Russia, then quite frankly, the Russian Navy can enter the waters of the North or Northern Island, because Moscow could take the line that it doesn't recognize British jurisdiction over the North of Ireland or Northern Ireland.
Let's go back to Mr. Harrison Phoenix. This is an issue that Mr. Papadopoulos has brought up on two occasions now. How does, in your opinion, all of this, the Black Sea incident, the Western troop buildup in Ukraine, in addition to NATO's eastward expansion, how does this all play into the rivalry between Russia and NATO? As we know, Russia has already made it clear that NATO membership for Ukraine would be a red line for Moscow.
Well, you have to remember, after the Berlin Wall came down, that the U.S. entered an agreement with the Russian Federation that NATO would not expand eastward. And they have violated that agreement both in the spirit and in implementation, because they have expanded greatly to the east. This was not what the Russian Federation signed on for, and the U.S. and NATO is in direct violation of that accord. So that is one point. You know, like I said, historically, Ukraine has been allied with Russia, and in fact, at one time, Kiev was the capital of the Russian Empire. The people there are essentially, you know, by genetic descent, are Russians. They are the Slavic people. And to try to peel that off of their close bond would be like the U.S. peeling away from Canada. And another analogy I'd like to make is can you imagine if the Russians or the Chinese would send warships into the Gulf of Mexico? The U.S. would be coming unglued, and they would use any means possible to expel them from that American lake down there that we call the Gulf of Mexico. That is exactly the position that the U.S. has put Russia in by needing to expel these foreign interlopers that have no claim and no business being in the Black Sea at all. The Black Sea is a Russian lake, and it has been, and it will continue to be, unless the U.S. and the Western forces of NATO wish to go to full-scale war with Russia, because they will defend their territory. And the U.S. has been aching for an engagement with Russia for some time. This is very, very unwise, and I really caution against it. And I really hope that the powers that be in the U.S. within our government come to their senses and back off of this, because this is extremely dangerous. As Mr. Papadopoulos has said, this could lead to a nuclear confrontation, whether it's at the tactical level or on the strategic level. In any case, it will be a disaster for the area and for all the people of the planet.
Mr. Papadopoulos, one detail that we skipped here was the war of words between Moscow and London, which escalated on Thursday. Both sides accused one another of giving inaccurate accounts of the incident. Moscow's version of events goes as such that a Russian aircraft bombed the path of the British destroyer. London dismisses Moscow's version of events as, quote-unquote, predictably inaccurate. What do you see with these two different and somewhat contradicting accounts?
Well, they certainly are contradictory accounts. However, the Russian version of events has been corroborated by the Kremlin. There is footage of the standoff between a Russian tactical fighter aircraft and HMS Defender, but also we have insiders from the British Ministry of Defence and also from British journalists who were on board HMS Defender at the time, who have also confirmed that the Russian version of events is the accurate version and that 10 Downing Street is not telling the truth. But let me add this. There will be no further NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. There may be NATO expansion into Southeastern Europe, specifically Serbia and Bosnia, but as regards NATO expansion into Eastern Europe, that has come to an end because the Kremlin will use all means at its disposal, and I mean all means at its disposal to ensure that Ukraine never enters NATO, because a Ukraine in NATO would mean that Russian national security would be seriously compromised. Russia would no longer be the dominant naval power in the Black Sea. NATO tactical aircraft operating from Ukrainian territory could enter the skies above Moscow in 12 to 15 minutes. So there will be no further NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. And secondly, I would say this to Whitehall, to the British government. Instead of attempting to goad Russia by deploying Royal Naval vessels into Russian maritime waters, Whitehall should instead ensure that the Royal Navy is protecting the English Channel from illegal immigrants who are crossing on a daily basis from France into England, specifically Dover, because British taxpayers' money is being misused. British sailors are being, the lives of British sailors are being put in danger in the Black Sea. British sailors should be in the English Channel defending England, defending Dover from illegal immigration from Calais. I think the British taxpayer, if they knew the full story, if Britain had a free and independent media, would be livid at the knowledge that the Royal Navy, instead of defending the English Channel, is deployed to the Black Sea and is potentially risking a military and nuclear confrontation with Russia, which, as I said at the beginning of this programme, would, if it came about,
right,
signal the end of mankind.
Let's get one last question in from Mr. Harrison Phoenix, Russia. As you mentioned, annexed the Crimean Peninsula following a referendum back in 2014. So obviously it considers areas around its coast to be Russian waters. Sergei Ryabkov said that Washington and London are sowing strife by refusing to accept Crimea as part of Russia. There is clear hypocrisy here again by the likes of the U.S. Mr. Papadopoulos mentioned a few instances, for example, the Malvinas, which are being have been annexed or, in other words, occupied by the British for years. There is another example also when the Israelis, they want to annex the Golan Heights, the United States accepts it. When they want to annex parts of the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, the United States will accept that. So they can accept illegal annexations and occupation by their allies, like the Israelis, but when it's not in their own interest, they'll oppose it.
Well, that's entirely accurate. And I need to agree with Mr. Papadopoulos again, because the U.S. has the same problem with our southern border. We should not be deploying troops around the world. We should be defending our own border and using our military resources to expel the invaders who are pouring into our country the same way that British soldiers, British sailors should be defending the British coast from the invasion of Calais. We've got the exact same problem here. It appears the Western governments are more driven to expand their empire and expand their grasp of control of the world's resources than they are in defending their own countries. And this is a mistake. This is not why people join our military. They join our military because they love our country, they want to defend it, but yet they're not defending our own borders. They're wide open, and we have immigrants pouring in from everywhere in the world. And this is just another symptom of the sickness that is going on within the United States government.
Okay.
Our government is ill. We need systemic reform here in the U.S., and we need to get a foreign policy that works for the American people, not for this expansion of Western empire.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. Author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. Also thanks to editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. And also special thanks to you for joining us, for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Four Saudis who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Mark Mazzetti, Julian Barnes, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled, Saudi Operatives Who Killed Khashoggi Received Paramilitary Training in United States. Four Saudi nationals who participated in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi received paramilitary training in the United States the previous year under a contract approved by the U.S. State Department, according to documents and people familiar with the arrangement. The instruction occurred as the secret unit responsible for Mr. Khashoggi's killing was beginning an extensive campaign of kidnapping, detention, and torture of Saudi citizens, ordered by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, to crush dissent inside the kingdom. The training was provided by the Arkansas-based security company Tier 1 Group, which is owned by the private equity firm Cerberus Capital Management. The company says the training, including safe marksmanship and countering an attack, was defensive in nature and devised to better protect Saudi leaders. One person familiar with the training said it also included work in surveillance and close quarters battle. There is no evidence that the American officials who provided the training or Tier 1 group executives knew that the Saudis were involved in the crackdown inside Saudi Arabia, but the fact that the government approved high-level military training for operatives who went to carry out the grisly killing of a journalist shows how intensely intertwined the United States has become with an autocratic nation, even as its agents committed horrific human rights abuses. It also underscores the perils of military partnerships with repressive governments and demonstrates how little oversight exists for those forces after they return home. Such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. The U.S. State Department initially granted a license for the paramilitary training of the Saudi Royal Guard to Tier 1 Group starting in 2014 during the Obama administration. The training continued during at least the first year of former President Donald J. Trump's term in office. Louis Bremer, a senior executive of Cerberus Capital Management, Tier 1 Group's parent company, confirmed his company's role in the training last year in written answers to questions from lawmakers as part of his nomination for a top Pentagon job during the Donald Trump administration. The administration does not appear to have sent the document to Congress before withdrawing Mr. Bremer's nomination. Lawmakers never received answers to their questions. In the document, which Louis Bremer provided to the New York Times, he said that four members of the Khashoggi kill team had received Tier 1 group training in 2017, and two of them had participated in a previous iteration of the training, which went from October of 2014 until January of 2015. The training provided was unrelated to their subsequent heinous acts, Louis Bremer said in his responses. He said that a March 2019 review by Tier 1 Group uncovered no wrongdoing by the company and confirmed that the established curriculum training was unrelated to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Louis Bremer said that the State Department, in collaboration with other U.S. departments and agencies, is responsible for vetting the foreign forces trained on U.S. soil. All foreign personnel trained by the Tier 1 group are cleared by the U.S. government for entry into the United States before commencement of their training. In a statement, Louis Bremer said that the training was protective in nature and that the company conducted no further training of Saudis after December of 2017. The Tier 1 group management, the board, and I stand firmly with the U.S. government, the American people, and the international community in condemning the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, he said. A 2019 column by David Ignatius of Washington Post first reported that members of the Khashoggi kill team had received training in the United States. David Ignatius wrote that the CIA had cautioned other government agencies that some special operations training may have been conducted by Tier 1 Group under a U.S. State Department license. The issue was central to Mr. Louis Bremer's contentious confirmation hearing and the written questions from senators asking him what role, if any, Tier 1 Group had in training Saudi nationals who had participated in the Jamal Khashoggi operation. A State Department spokesman declined to confirm whether it awarded licenses to Tier 1 Group for the Saudi training. This administration insists on responsible use of U.S. origin defense equipment and training by our allies and partners and considers appropriate responses if violations occur, said the spokesman Ned Price. Saudi Arabia faces significant threats to its territory, and we are committed to working together to help Riyadh strengthen its defenses. Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Saudi embassy in Washington did not comment. Former President Donald Trump weighed installing the head of Cerberus Capital Management, Steven Feinberg, in a top intelligence post last year, but the appointment was never made. While the Trump administration had appointed Mr. Feinberg to lead the president's intelligence advisory board in 2018, questions emerged about potential conflicts of interest. Cerberus Capital Management formerly owned the military contractor DynCorp, which among other things provides intelligence advice to the United States and other clients. It is unclear which members of the Khashoggi kill team participated in the Tier 1 group training. Seven members of the team belong to an elite unit charged with protecting the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, according to an American intelligence report about the assassination declassified in February. The role of operatives from the so-called Rapid Intervention Force in the Khashoggi killing helped bolster the American intelligence case that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation. Members of the Rapid Intervention Force would not have participated in the killing without his consent, according to the report. The group exists to defend the Saudi Crown Prince and answers only to him, the document said. Members of the team that killed Jamal Khashoggi were involved in at least a dozen operations starting in 2017, according to officials who have read declassified intelligence reports about the campaign. Mr. Khashoggi, a columnist with the Washington Post, was killed inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. His body was dismembered using a bone saw. The assassination brought widespread condemnation of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who tried to deny any knowledge of the operation. Eight defendants were sentenced to up to 2 decades in prison last year, but human rights advocates criticized the punishments as aimed at lower-level agents while sparing their leaders. The CIA concluded that the Saudi Crown Prince directed the operation, but Donald Trump said the evidence was inconclusive and that America's diplomatic and economic relationship with Saudi Arabia took priority. After President Joe Biden took office and debated the issue with his advisors before the release of the declassified intelligence report, his administration announced sanctions on Saudi citizens involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of the elite unit who protect the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But President Joe Biden chose not to directly punish the Saudi Crown Prince. The earlier iteration of the training, which took place during the Obama administration, occurred before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman consolidated his power in the kingdom. His predecessor as Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, was a close ally of the United States and in particular of John O. Brennan, who served as CIA Director General under President Barack Obama. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef was the Saudi counterterrorism chief and collaborated closely with the Obama administration officials. In 2017, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman pushed Prince Mohammed bin Nayef from power and executed a broader campaign to wrest power from his rivals, including a notorious episode of imprisoning Saudi royals and businessmen at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. The Trump administration considered him a valuable partner in the Middle East, and Prince Mohammed bin Salman developed a close relationship with Jared Kushner. The former president's son-in-law, who served as a senior advisor to Donald Trump. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the son of King Salman, is the next in line to the Saudi throne. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef remains under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. The Tier 1 Group website lists numerous American special operations and intelligence units as clients, along with specialty units that do not require recognition. It said it also trains OGA special operator teams, one pseudonym for CIA paramilitary units, as well as international allied forces. Under federal rules that restrict foreign sales of American arms and military expertise, Tier 1 Group was required to apply for licenses to train the foreign operatives. Those license applications were examined by State Department officials who were processing tens of thousands of licenses per year, and they were approved. The approval would have allowed members of the Saudi Royal Guard to enter the United States on visas processed by the American Embassy in Riyadh. The path is similar to the one followed by Second Lieutenant Mohammad al-Shamrani, a Royal Saudi Air Force officer who opened fire in 2019 at a naval air station in Pensacola, Florida, where he was receiving military flight training. That attack killed at least 3 people and wounded 8 others.
Good morning.
beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.